Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're due for your biannual cleaning, something you usually forget and would rather not remember. But you just got a reminder from the dentist you look forward to seeing. The Gentle Dentist, the only dentist you're happy to come back to. The Gentle Dentist in Worthington. How can we make you smile? Call 614-431-3311.
When this decision was decided, Trump was the prohibitive favorite to win re-election, and he's promised to prosecute his opponents. So it's not like they're looking at something that's a pie in the sky, possible hypothetical. That's why I went out of my way to say, look, it's a legit policy question how much you want to protect a prior president from prosecution by a future president. That's a legitimate question to raise. It's just decided by the founders already, not by the court.
Welcome to Beg to Differ. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark. And I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston, who writes for The Wall Street Journal and is affiliated with the Brookings Institution, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, and Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter, Notes from the Middle Ground. Our special guest this week is David French, who will be joining us in a little while to discuss Trump v. United States. But first, we are going to begin with the campaign. We now have the Democratic ticket. First of all, it's nice to see you guys again. I've been away. The highlight and lowlight segment, I'll explain why I wasn't here last week. But I do want to just begin with Tim Walz. Now, cards on the table. I was hoping for Josh Shapiro, but Linda, you and I spoke, and you are completely on board with the Walz choice. Tell us why you think it's a good thing.
Well, like you, and I assume like a couple of other people on the show, I was a big Josh Shapiro fan. But, you know, I watched the whole introduction. I watched him come out on stage. I watched Josh Shapiro, first of all, introduce Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. And I thought, God, he's so terrific. He's just a wonderful speaker. And then I thought, you know, he sort of is a better speaker than Kamala Harris is. He's got a real rhetorical gift. And I could see, as reports have it, that she was... her people were somewhat concerned that he would overshadow her. But when I saw Tim Walz come on, my first reaction is, I think, what everybody's reaction was. This is every man. This is somebody normal. This is not an obvious politician. It's not somebody who's obviously ideological. He looks like, talks like, has an affect like middle America. And the more he talked, the more I listened to him, the better I felt. Then I started talking to some of my friends who are Democrats, unlike me.
Your private focus groups, Linda?
My private focus groups who come, you know, from my history when I was a Democrat and working for a teachers union. And I think they were quite excited by him and by that pick. And I think I've said on this show before that teachers are the shock troops of the Democratic Party. They are the people who do the work to get people to the polls, to, you know, make the phone calls, do the mailings, do door to door. And Josh Shapiro had a problem with the teachers union. It happens to be a problem that I admire him for. He's for school choice. But nonetheless, I think her picking him was a good thing. And I think he just is warm and funny. And I love seeing the clips of him with his daughter, Hope, Hope and Gus, is, I think, are his two children's names. And I just, you know, I ended up feeling quite comfortable. Do I agree with him? No, I don't agree with Kamala Harris on most things. But given the alternative, I think that he is energizing this party in a way that it needs to be energized.
Damon, I have to say the part of his introductory speech in Philadelphia that I thought was the most affecting was when he talked about IVF, and he said that he and his wife had struggled with fertility and that when they were able to bring home their daughter, they named her Hope. And I thought that was beautiful and touching. I wasn't completely thrilled about the reference to the couch vis-a-vis J.D. Vance. I mean, there are enough true things that you can go after Trump and Vance on. You don't need to use fake news, literally. But I don't know. People can differ on that if they want to. Okay, I think Linda accurately described the strengths of Tim Walz, the everyman quality, the sincerity, the relatability. He's got some weaknesses, though. You want to tackle those, like the George Floyd protests, how he handled that? He was very late to call in the National Guard, some say.
Right. And but of course, you know, Trump has stepped on his own toes on that now because he apparently praised him for how he handled
True.
It at the time. So Trump will always get in his own way. So it will not be as easy for the Trump fans ticket to go after him on that now as it would have otherwise. There will always be a clip to play in response. You know, obviously, anyone who follows politics is going to respond to what they saw at the Philadelphia rally when he was introduced on the stage with Kamala Harris and his subsequent appearances and say, that's a guy who's got something. He has that spark, that charisma. And as Linda said, a kind of the everyday Midwestern guy feel to him that makes him very relatable. He is funny, which is unusual, and Trump has that in his sinister way, but he is amusing.
And that
is part of his appeal. Yeah, it's not to me, but I understand why some people love to kind of guffaw with Trump. But, you know, Walz has that too. My skepticism about him, which is connected to my admiration for my governor, Josh Shapiro, and disappointment at this choice to some extent, has to do with weather vibes, which is, of course, what we're talking about. This is like the political word of the year. Everything's about vibes. Walz wins on vibes, but do vibes win votes? And I'm not sure that they do. Walz did well winning a red-leaning rural district in Minnesota for 5 cycles as a House member. He then became governor of Minnesota, running statewide in a bluer state than the key states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And he won re-election in 2022 with 52% of the vote by 7.7 points. That's not great for a Democrat in a blue state. And I think a good reason why is because he ran on a strategy of running up the total in the blue, the deep blue, biggest cities in the state. And he performed meh in rural districts. He did better than Hillary Clinton had done because she kind of hit bottom for those voters. He did a little worse than Biden had done in 2020, and he did a lot worse than Obama had done with those voters. Those are exactly the kinds of voters that Josh Shapiro has proven that he can get. And they're the kind of voters that Amy Klobuchar has proven that she can really get. In 2018, she won re-election by 24 points.
Wow.
So by those standards, Walz actually underperforms with exactly the people Harris needs to woo to her side to win this. Now, there are all kinds of other variables at play. So Maybe he'll win a little bit more and it'll be enough when combined with other factors. And in the end, no one will care because she'll win and we'll all be just happy and singing our happy tune on the way to Inauguration Day in January. But if she falls short and loses because she loses Pennsylvania, this will be a rare case where you really could look back on this and say, that was the mistake. Was picking him instead of Josh Shapiro. Not guaranteed she'd win Pennsylvania for her, but he's shown that he can win more of those voters, I think, than Waltz.
Okay, Bill, two of my colleagues here at the Bulwark, Tim Mueller and Sarah Longwell, had an interesting discussion a little earlier this week where they were saying that at the Bulwark, we're kind of expat Republicans. And they were saying, this pick, which by the way, has been described in the press that Kamala Harris was looking for to balance the ticket. Right. And, what they said is this isn't quite balancing the ticket. This is a liberal's idea of what a middle American looks like. You know, somebody who goes hunting occasionally and, wears Carhartt clothes. But they said, actually, he's very liberal and everybody in the more, center part of the country, that is politically as well as geographically, will recognize him as such. They know what liberals look like and they're not going to have any trouble recognizing him as a liberal, even though he shoots a gun and, was a football coach. What do you say?
I say the same thing. I've now written two articles, analytical and tempered, rather than expressing the full force of my feelings on the subject, laying out my arguments as to why I thought that this was not the right pick. Some of them overlap with points that Damon has made. Minnesota is a state that she is going to win. Pennsylvania is the state that she cannot afford to lose. And it's not clear to me that enough weight was given to that very simple proposition. Second, I think it's fair to say that Walls, and it's pronounced, I'm told, Walls, not Waltz.
Mm-hmm.
Walls is to her as J.D. Vance is Trump, minus the age. He's an intensifier and not an outreacher. This is a uniformly liberal ticket in an anything but uniformly liberal country. Second or third, I've lost track of which point I'm on. I just want to underscore and expand Damon's point. I've actually looked at the internals of Walz's victory versus Shapiro's victory. Walz did no better than Biden in a single piece of the electorate. And he ended up with exactly the 52% that Joe Biden had a couple of years earlier. By contrast, Josh Shapiro ran 7 points ahead of Biden. And he outperformed him in the rural and small town areas by that margin. And he was ahead of Biden in virtually every category. I'll refrain from the lawyer's Latin, but the matter speaks for itself. Third or fourth?
Let me push back on that for a second, Bill.
Yeah.
Shapiro had the advantage of running against a lunatic. So that has to be, you have to play that into this. The Mastriano was an election denier who had filled buses full of people to go to January 6th. He was so extreme that he probably did some of Shapiro's work for him. No?
I can't deny that, but I think that has less explanatory power in the small town and rural, very Trumpy areas than it does in the two big cities that have so many of the votes. And so I say unrepentantly that Shapiro was stronger in his state versus Biden than Walz was in his. And finally, you know, moving from vibes to facts, I do think that the Harris campaign has underestimated some of the weaknesses of this candidate, which I am sure the Trump-Vance ticket will seek to exploit, including, you know, driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. And whatever we want to say about that as a policy matter, there are large swaths of the country where that just simply doesn't play very well. And I could walk through his record pointing out other things like that. The argument that he's a liberal's idea of a Midwestern moderate is, that's the line I was going to use myself. I decided for reasons of personal relationships with various of my Democratic friends that I wouldn't, but it is God's honest truth. You know, I really think that, you know, that the two of them, you know, Miller and Sarah Longwell got that right. So he is a safe choice that didn't raise any hackles with the organized groups in the party. But I can tell you this, a lot of Jews who are not conservatives are quietly very troubled by the whispering campaign against Shapiro, in which we now know the Trump campaign participated covertly with some of the progressive groups who were on point. I'm not a happy camper. I think this was the first unforced error of her campaign.
Okay, so Linda, I see that based on Damon's and Bill's reactions, I see that I have to be devil's advocate here. So let me play devil's advocate, and I'm going to start with you, Linda, and I'm going to say, all right, well, you could say that this, first of all, gives Kamala Harris now the freedom to really pivot. Now she has completely consolidated the Democratic base. The liberals, the progressives are all happy and united. And so she now has more scope to be sending out more centrist signals. And she's already started to do that, even in the first 2.5 weeks since she's been the clear nominee. So she has backed away from her opposition to fracking. She has pivoted on immigration, embracing the Lankford bill. She has backed off from her position on Medicare, for her 2019 position on Medicare for All. Doesn't this, again, playing devil's advocate, does this give her more scope to pivot to the center?
I'm not sure that it does. And I think more importantly, I'm not sure that she wants to do that. I mean, that's my big concern, is she really capable of taking that middle road and reaching out to moderate voters. And I do think she has to do it if she wants to win. I do understand both Damon and Bill's point about Walz. I do understand Bill's point that he's made repeatedly about curbing our enthusiasm, that enthusiasm only gets you so far. On the other hand, she's showing herself to be capable of drawing 10,000-12,000 people on very short notice and sometimes in very uncomfortable conditions, like being outside at an airplane hangar where people had to walk literally a couple of miles to get there.
In the heat,
right. And so, it's a kind of balancing act, but that will only take her so far. And she is still, I think, in a prolonged honeymoon, but it is still a honeymoon. And they haven't really started to hit her aggressively with the kind of attacks and ads. Trump has flailed about that. He's, instead of attacking her for liberal positions, he's questioned her racial identity. But at some point, I assume they're going to get more competent over on the Trump campaign. And then it's going to be a matter of her defining herself. And the one criticism that Trump has made that I think is legitimate is that she hasn't had any press conference yet. He's busy as we're recording, having a press conference down at Mar-a-Lago. And she does do a really good job on the stump. She's very good at reading the teleprompter. She puts enthusiasm into it. She's a good rhetorical speaker, but she's also got to be able to handle tough questions thrown her way and do it in an articulate manner. And that's my biggest worry right now.
What do you think, Damon? Does she have to meet the press? I mean, some people are saying, you know, the press is certainly saying she has to, but does she? What's the disadvantage in waiting until after Labor Day to have a sit down with a network, or does she need to do that at all? What do you think?
Well, I don't think there's a lot at stake on whether she does it between now and the convention. Eventually, I do think she's going to have to. First of all, because of just expectations that the Trump people are going to keep hammering her on this. And there is a history of that being a normal thing for a candidate to do. So it's not even going to come off as pure making hay on the part of the Trump campaign. It's going to
And also there's a history of her flubbing a sit down interview.
Yes.
So she has to overcome that.
She has to. And then there's the added problem that as much as I'm thrilled that she's changed her views on fracking and about 75 other little things that she said in 2019, those require an explanation. Now, I realize there's a kind of double standard here because on the other side, you have J.D. Vance, who called Trump America's potential Hitler, and he's now his VP. So,
right.
Like, does he have to have a sit down in which he carefully explains how he, you know, rationally came up with a change of mind on this? I don't know. I mean, he tries. He did in that Ross Douthat interview in the Times a month or so ago that I flagged here on the podcast. But, you know, there is a way in which Trump's flailing on policy all over the map is something that never really gets pinned down. There's never an adequate explanation for why he holds his view on abortion now versus what he said in 2016 and
or when he was before he was a Republican.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a double standard, but you know what? The Democrats are the party of reasoning and policy statements that are supposed to make sense and be able to be parsed by people who think about this stuff for a living. And so the standards simply are a little higher, and it's going to look bad if she expects the American people to just accept that she's changed on 19 policies to move to the center while not ever explaining why, like what it was. Now, I do want to add that no one has mentioned this, and I'm delighted because now I get to mention it. In Detroit on Wednesday night, Kamala Harris at her rally had, I will now read the opening paragraphs of the Times account of it because it's more efficient than me trying to explain it. When protesters first interrupted Vice President Kamala Harris at a rally in Detroit on Wednesday evening, she smiled with a gentle corrective. "I'm speaking now." But as the disruption continued, her patience ran thin. Quote, "You know what?" Ms. Harris said with the sudden force and resolve of a parent in the driver's seat who has had it. Quote, "If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking." As the crowd roared, Ms. Harris stayed silent, jaw set, eyes fixed. More of that, please. That is her sister soldier moment to an extent. And it's a tiny one in the sense that it's not involved a shift in policy, but it is in the sense of showing, I am not going to bow down by the left-wing protesters who come after me and just take it and say, "Oh yes, I'm so sorry, would you like to tell us your view on the Gaza war right now at my rally?" No, she's going to say, "You're being rude and pipe down and to say, as she did, like, you're only helping my opponent right now, so why don't you shut up? Like, that affect, if that gets repeated and she shows that kind of toughness toward the left, I think could help in a lot of ways, including on some of the wending her way through these policy shifts.
Okay. So, Bill, I saw you shaking your head as Damon was speaking. So let me, before turning the floor to you, just add my two cents about what Damon said, which is that in a way, that moment, if even if it's not repeated, well, preferably if it is repeated, but it's possible to interpret it, I think, not necessarily as a rejection of the left, you know, the really hard left of the Democratic Party, though it could be that. But it could also just be the kind of moment that some of us recall from 1980 when Ronald Reagan in Nashua, New Hampshire, sort of fiercely said, I'm paying for this microphone. The reason that was so effective was that it showed leadership. He was in command of the moment. And Kamala Harris was in command of that room with thousands of people in it. And that's leadership. What do you say?
I will let your point speak for itself and simply say that reflecting on, I think it was your conjecture about the opportunity to pivot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way this sub-segment began. I want to say two things about that. Number one, there are about a million videos out there from 2018, 2019, and 2020. Do you think the Trump campaign is going to withdraw ads using those videos just because she said, I don't believe that anymore? They're just going to keep on hammering away. And they will make the point that not so long ago, that is not only what she believed and campaigned for president on. And so I think, I think Damon's point, namely, she isn't free just to say, I don't believe that anymore and leave it at that is a political reality. I really believe that. Number two, yes, she does have an opportunity to pivot. And the question is now, in which direction? Let me read you something that also pivots off her visit to Detroit. This is from the Jerusalem Post, and it says, Vice President Harris's campaign is doing damage control on Thursday morning, reaffirming her support for Israel after initial reports of her meeting with pro-Palestinian leaders before a rally in Detroit suggested that the vice president expressed an openness to an arms embargo for Israel. I suspect that I'm not the only person on this panel who is aware of this exchange. And of course, Phil Gordon and everybody else is now busy cleaning it up.
He's her foreign policy advisor.
Exactly. And he's a, I know him. He's a, he's a good guy. He knows better. Suffice it to say, I have to believe that something happened during that exchange that is now forcing the campaign to do official cleanup, complete with quotes from Phil Gordon.
Well, you were saying, which way is she going to pivot, was
exactly
your question.
And it is just as possible that she will try to placate the portions of the base that are unhappy with her by tending in their direction as it is that she will move in the other direction. And so at this point, I don't know what to think.
Well, what do you make of the fact that she did pivot toward the center with rejection of all of those things she said in 2019?
Well,
I mean, she's already done that.
I can give you a one sentence explanation of her change on fracking. And that is that it is a very important part of the Pennsylvania energy economy.
Yes, but she, you could also do a one sentence explanation for picking Josh Shapiro, and it's the same explanation, namely Pennsylvania, and she didn't do that.
Well, okay, and and I can give you a one sentence reply, and that is in both cases, she did what the politics of the moment required. And in the politics of the moment, The hammering that she was getting from certain quarters over Shapiro's views on Israel and public education was doing the work. Look, I'm sorry to be the skunk at the garden party. Alan Greenspan's famous phrase, irrational exuberance, leaps to the lips here. I think we have to be cooler analysts of the situation and, you know, consider the possibility that conventional wisdom has moved as a herd, and we have a choice either of moving with it or raising questions about it.
Okay, Linda, were you part of a herd?
Oh, yes, I'm just a sheep, and I just sort of follow. Look, it is true that I want there to be a chance of defeating Donald Trump. There's no question about that. It is, you know, it is important to me. And therefore, you know, I've said many times, I wouldn't have picked Kamala as the candidate. In fact, listening to Josh Shapiro, I thought, yet again, wouldn't it have been great if there had been a nominating convention and he'd been able to be the nominee? If she does not pivot, if she does not move to the center, she will lose the election. There are not enough hardcore Democrats to elect her. It is really up to that, you know, slight segment of the population that moved to Biden when they were fed up with Trump. And she needs to get those people back. And not sure anything she's done yet. I mean, obviously, you know, Waltz is supposed to appeal to white guys and hunters and, you know, gun owners, etc. But she's got to do some things on policy, and her message of freedom and we won't go back. Again, those are bumper stickers, and she's got to come up with something more that is going to convince people that she is indeed willing to move to the middle.
Damon, let me ask you this. Assuming that Kamala Harris listens to this podcast and decides, you know what, it's really not enough for me to say that I don't believe in banning fracking anymore and that I'm no longer endorsing Medicare for all and, you know, whatever, and that I'm pivoting, that I need to have an explanation. What would you suggest the explanation should be? You know, it can't be, I looked at the polls, right?
To be honest, I have never worked in the role of a political strategist, and it is not a career path for me. I am not suited to it. I know the answer is I looked at the polls, and combined with the fact that the Democratic Party went a little nuts in 2019 and 2020, and she followed it that way. I mean, the Democratic Party, while Trump was president, really, and I don't mean all Democrats, because who won the primary? The one moderate guy on the stage, Joe Biden. So I don't mean to impugn the party as a whole. What I mean are the groups, basically the activist core of the party under Trump were like constantly triggered. They were shocked by Hillary Clinton's loss. They were appalled by what they saw as a huge moral backsliding toward the bad American past of racism and xenophobia and so forth. And they reacted to that by basically tripling down on the most, extreme version of progressive wish list items across the board. And what you saw on the debate stages through the summer and fall of 2019 during the Democratic debates was a kind of race among like a dozen people to prove I'm the most progressive person here. And she was a part of that. She took part in it. You know, some of those debates began with a 20-minute debate about who was more in favor of Medicare for all, as if we live in a reality where you could imagine a Democrat, one, winning on that basis. And then even if the Democrat did win, that person would then have a Congress that would be able to make Medicare for all a reality. It was delusions. And she participated in it because she thought, I think very wrongly, that was how she could win the nomination. They all thought that. But instead, Joe Biden, kept coming onto the debate stage and saying, no, it's malarkey. And he won. And since then, the party, I think, has sobered up quite a lot. And she realizes now that, well, yeah, I can't win if I say that. That was a primary in a particularly marginal moment. And now I'm running for president and I have 3 months. And how does she finesse that in the explanations? I really don't know. That's no doubt one reason why they're putting off the press avails, because it's a hard problem. They're like half a, they're like a dozen and a half things that they could point to. And on a lot of them, she's going to want to say she's moved. But if she can't just be as honest as saying, well, because that was crazy, and I know I'll lose if I say that. She can't say that. So she has to come up with, like, something happened that made me change my mind in a way that makes sense, that could make sense to voters, why she thought it made sense then and now it doesn't, and this other thing makes sense. That's a hard task. Times, like, I don't know, 16, I don't remember, maybe it's only 9 things, but it's a lot. And it's a hard nut to crack. And I bet there are people in the Harris campaign spending a lot of time burning the midnight oil, trying to figure this out. And it's hard. And, you know, maybe there's some of them, maybe Harris herself hopes, maybe we don't have to do it. Maybe I can just have such a great convention and ride the vibes all the way to November without having to look at it. But I agree with, I think, everyone on the podcast that won't quite cut it. It's going to, there's going to have to be a rubber to the road moment.
Bill Galston, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I remember that Amy Klobuchar was not in the stampede to the left in those debates in 2019. I think she didn't endorse Medicare for All and a few of these other ideas. But, you know, people, I guess, were so snake bit about what happened to Hillary that they were reluctant. They thought maybe Hillary lost because she was a woman. And yeah, it was like, oh, Biden, he's a good old fashioned male Democrat. We'll go there. Anyway, that's all speculation on my part, though I do think I'm right about Klobuchar. Correct me if you remember differently. But then I also want to ask you about the same question I asked Damon. How does she do it? I'm not sure it's really, I'm not sure that voters really demand that much. I think they just need something to put their hooks into. So if she says, you know, I served for 3.5 years as vice president, and I saw with Joe Biden how, you know, you can get things done if you're willing to, you know, to reach across the aisle and be a deal maker. God, no, that sounds like Trump. But anyway, I've learned a lot as vice president, and she can talk about how fracking is actually better for the environment than, you know, certain other technologies. She can talk about how, you know, the border, you know, the Democrats in Congress have come up with a great border solution and she backs it. The Lankford bill, you know, and that sort of thing. Is it really such a difficult thing for her to provide a reasonable explanation for her move?
I think you're on the right track, Mona. You know, especially the focus on what she's learned, which I think can be turned into a kind of plus. Mm-hmm. You know, I served a president for 3.5 years, you know, who's both, you know, positions and his conduct taught me a lot about how to be president. And this is one of these areas in which I'd like to think that I've learned something, not only about, you know, the importance of this activity to local economies, but also the need to make hard choices about how we create an energy transition to a carbon-free world that does not crater the economy. Because if we do that, we're never going to get there. In other words, yeah, this is not rocket science.
It's not. It's pretty simple.
It's pretty simple. But I guess the only point I'm making is that first of all, let me say, I yield to no one in this program, in my desire to see Donald Trump sent packing once and for all. And everything I'm saying is in the name of my views as to how she can become a stronger candidate with an even better chance of doing that. This is, you know, and I, you know, I do think, I do hope that she comes to the conclusion that she will be stronger if she explains herself than if she comes to believe that the need for an explanation will simply go away and it will be a viable election for the next 89 days or whatever it is.
That's Linda Chavez, as the only person on this panel who has actually run for office,
yes,
I would like to hear your views about how a candidate should handle this situation.
Well, I wouldn't know because I lost it. I lost big time. And by the way, I don't think I changed my position on anything. I think I may have fudged a little about whether I would support a constitutional amendment to protect the U.S. flag, which I thought was a very bad idea. But I think I tried to evade questions on that. I mean, you know.
Are you pro-flag or anti-flag?
Yeah,
you
right,
mean you're anti-flag,
yeah,
Linda
right.
Thomas?
I know. Yeah. But, you know, I didn't change positions. And okay. As a result, I didn't win. I lost it. I didn't just lose by a little. I lost by a lot. I only got 40% of the vote, just under 40% of the vote.
All right. Well, okay. Let's now hear from our sponsors. So this podcast is being brought to us by Miracle Made. It's hot outside and your nighttime bedroom temperature has a huge impact on your sleep quality. If you wake up too hot or too cold, I recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Miracle Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver infused fabrics that are temperature regulating so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat, leads to all kinds of diseases. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require less laundry. So they are self-cleaning because of the silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. They are designed for your skin. And they are comfort and quality that is unmatched, better than you will find in many five-star hotels. So if you would like to try them, go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo code BEGTODIFFER at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle's so confident in their product, they back it with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to miraclemade.com/begtodiffer and use that code BEGTODIFFER to claim your free 3-piece towel set. Again, trymiracle.com/begtodiffer. Treat yourself, and we thank Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. And now we will move to our next topic and welcome David French, New York Times columnist and podcaster extraordinaire. David, lovely to see you.
Great to see you, Mona.
I was particularly eager to talk with David about the Supreme Court decision in Trump v. U.S. This did happen a few weeks ago, but it is so important, and there's nobody whose opinion I trust more than David. So I want David to go through with you and the rest of the panel. What do we have here? This case struck me as probably the most shocked that I've ever been, I think, reading a Supreme Court opinion. I was completely unprepared for this conservative, textualist, originalist court majority to invent law out of whole cloth the way they did. And it starting from the fact that they created, as I mentioned in my email to you, You know, this is the court that said that Roe was wrongly decided because it just there was no basis in the text or in the text of the Constitution for finding a right to abortion, and yet they found and by the way, Roe had three tiers, you know, of protection for abortions. Well, this has three tiers of presidential immunity that is arguably just as invented as the three-tier test in Roe. Am I overreacting?
I don't think so. I would call myself moderately surprised by the ruling, not shocked out of my mind. But the court doesn't often surprise me. So when I'm surprised, that's unusual. Because, you know, I feel like if you really follow this court closely, if you really understand the justices and sort of don't look at them through the prism of, oh, they're Republican appointees and they're always going to back the right and the liberal appointees, Democratic appointees are always going to back the left. If you look at it robustly with their actual jurisprudence, you've seen that the Republican appointees on the court have not, in fact, always backed Donald Trump or the right.
And no,
they have many times disappointed MAGA to the extent where DeSantis was even running, criticizing Trump's choices of Gorsuch, Barrett, and Kavanaugh. So I did not see the court through the prism of this is an institution that is MAGA, that is Trump sympathetic. And that's one reason why I did not think the immunity ruling would come out the way that it did. That's why I was surprised. And it is atextual. It is not textual. Just to take one point of this, Article 1, Section 3, Clause 7 of the Constitution says, judgments in case of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of trust or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. Now, obviously Trump was not impeached and convicted, but this ruling actually modifies that clause.
It does.
And so that's why I said it's atextual. It's more than atextual. In many ways, it contradicts the text, which originalism is not supposed to do. And so this was surprising to me, and it was, I think, dangerous.
Absolutely. And the court's rationale for creating this enormous zone of immunity from any kind of criminal prosecution for the president is based on separation of powers and the idea that the president has to have, I forget the exact wording they use, something like he has to be fearless in the execution of his duties or something like that. And the fact is, as the dissent objected, wait a minute, don't we want presidents to be, first of all, the president has the benefit of lots of counsel about what's legal and illegal before he acts. He he can always say that the attorney general told him that what he was doing was legal. So that would be an affirmative defense. But in any event, don't we want presidents to be more constrained in their use of the vast power that we give them? Do we want presidents to feel unfettered when we give them more power than we give any other individual in the system?
Well, I mean, I think the answer to that is no. The longer amplification is heck no. But we do not want them to have that degree of autonomy. But I would even question the premise that says that unless we give them this level of immunity, that they won't be able to act fearlessly. And I'll just go to the example of generals in the military. General Mattis, when he was commanding, I believe, as a Marine brigade in the initial invasion of Iraq, he acted fearlessly time and time and time again, and boldly and decisively. And the whole time he's subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The whole time he's subject to the operation of law. And so it is not true that subjecting a leader, even a leader involved in war, it is not true that they act fearfully and tentatively when they're under the rule of law. Here's how I would here's how I would steel man their approach, Mona. If you're going to say, okay, why would they do this? Why would they do this? So the steel manning is this. They looked at two slippery slopes. Slippery slope number one is, what happens if we give a lot of immunity to presidents? What will happen? Slippery slope number two is, what happens if presidents are vulnerable to prosecution for official acts? And they, it seems to me that they deemed slippery slope number two more dangerous than slippery slope number one. That the idea that a next president would prosecute the previous president was more dangerous in their view than the idea that a president would act lawlessly with impunity, because there would still be the impeachment and conviction remedy. You could do something about it in the moment. Now, okay, I think that's an interesting policy argument. What's more dangerous? However, what I would say is that wasn't your call to make. The call was already made. And the call was already made when, obviously, the Constitution understands what sovereign immunity is. It gave particular kinds of immunity quite specifically to members of Congress. Think of the speech and debate clause, for example. And it did not. It did not for presidents. And so the answer to that argument, which I do think is a valid policy argument, what's sort of scarier for democracy? That's, we can have that discussion. But a judge walking in is not walking in with a blank slate policy argument. They're walking in with a text. And the text here communicated a few things quite clearly. One is, hey, we know all about immunity. In fact, we'll give it intentionally in very limited areas. And then it communicated quite clearly that, hey, even if you're impeached and convicted, don't think that's the end of the day for you. You can still be subject to criminal law. And anytime the court reaches a conclusion that actually makes some of the text of the Constitution meaningless or unworkable, that's when I think you've had an originalism fail of the first order.
Wow. Okay. So I am extremely exercised about this decision. So I have one more thing before I turn you over to the other members of my panel. And it's this, because I took these justices, these conservative judges, at their word that they were textualists and that they were faithful to the Constitution. And this decision just strikes me as so contrary to any reasonable understanding of the text. The Constitution, by its express words in the impeachment clause, imagines a president being impeached and punished for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Bribery. So what conceivable situation would a president accept a bribe, accept in exchange for an official act? Right? I mean, right. It's inconceivable. So this decision seems to contradict the Constitution, doesn't it?
Well, and it, here's the thing that's also telling about it, Mona. If the smartest people in law can read the opinion and not actually agree on whether it protects bribery or not, there's a problem with the opinion. So there are people who read this opinion and say, no, Mona, David, you're all wrong. This does not protect bribery, because accepting money in exchange for an official act, that's what's being punished, not the official act. But that's not how the dissent reads it. And the footnote that is supposed to address the dissent is as clear as mud.
Right.
And so it would have been so easy to write a footnote that says, you know, our dissenting colleagues are wrong. Bribery can still be prosecuted.
Right.
But it doesn't, it's not nearly that clear. So I read it and I think, well, if it's bribery for a core function, like, I'm going to pay you $5 million to order a drone strike against a person overseas.
Right.
No one, I mean, ordering a strike is a core function. So as I read it, if it's a bribery for a core function, scot-free. If it's bribery
for— And you
for
can't even introduce evidence about the president's motive.
Right. No evidence for the president. But if it's bribery about something in the outer evident edge of the official act world, then— It's not scot-free, but how do you prove it if you can't introduce evidence of motive?
Right.
It's And this is Justice Barrett's problem as well. Justice Barrett's problem was, wait, what are we doing with all of this evidence stuff? And yeah, it is. And so it would be very, very, very easy to write an opinion that says, well, whatever you think about what's official act, a core act, outer peripheral act, bribery, you can prosecute. Like mm-hmm. you could say that, but it doesn't mm-hmm. say that.
And it doesn't.
And the other thing that I think is really important about this, because I am not one of these people who says the court's illegitimate, that they're corrupt. I disagree with the ruling. But here's what I would also say. There's an interesting, there's this concept called Miles's Law, which says where you stand is based on where you sit. Mm-hmm. A lot of these guys are executive branch veterans. Kavanaugh, for example, Roberts, for example, they came up in the executive branch, and it came up in a conservative executive branch, for example, that was convinced of this unitary executive theory that really, I think, it would be interesting to see if you'd had some of these justices who'd come up more through the legislature, who'd come up more through legislative branches. So I do think there's a kind of a subtle executive branch bias, and then there's something else going on. This court really dives into history a lot, a ton. And part of my concerns is that they're allowing some of their readings of history to trump the text. Mm-hmm. If the originalism formulation that they're leaning towards is text, history, tradition, text is first. But I fear that sometimes what they're doing is history, tradition, text. Mm-hmm. And that's what this opinion feels like to me. It's more history, tradition, text than it is text, history, tradition.
Yep. Okay. Anybody else on this panel want to defend the 9 justices or at least the 6? All right. Bill Galston. I'm just joking, obviously.
Yeah, right. I don't want to defend them, you know, but I do want to build on David's last point, which I think takes us close to the heart of the matter. This has been a long theme among conservative activists, and it goes back even farther than the unitary executive decision, rather discussion in the George W. Bush administration. I remember a conference at AEI in the late 1980s. The theme of the papers presented was, and I quote, the fettered presidency. And the AEI at the very end of the Reagan administration, January of 1989, put out a book with that title, with a foreword by Robert Bork, in which the clear argument was that Congress and the courts had been busy creating fetters, you know, obstacles to the, to the full and appropriate use of presidential power. And if, you know, and I know many of the people who contributed essays to that volume, and their experience shaped by the Reagan administration, you know, and I think in particular the Iran-Contra affair, but it went farther than that, was that the president was being hemmed in, that the Congress was preventing the president from being the chief steward of American foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and of course, all the anti-torture activity in the early 2000s, you know, was seen as an imposition on, you know, the president's power to make tough but necessary discretionary decisions in extraordinary circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't help but see this decision as the outcome of 40 years of movement conservative complaints about unreasonable restraints on presidential power. But I think there was a lot of emotional animus built up on this theme.
Well, you know, I think that's a fascinating history, because here's what I would say. Every movement loves to enhance the power of the branch of government it controls.
Exactly.
So, Bill, when you said the end of the Reagan administration, this was an era in which Republicans won at one point 5 out of 6 presidential elections. And with the only exception between Nixon, Carter, Reagan, Bush was that very narrow Carter win with only one term. And so it is fascinating to me that, and not at all surprising that, you know, and then the unitary executive theory comes up during the Bush administration. And I don't know if you guys remember in the flush of victory after 04, a lot of people thought we might be on the verge of an enduring Republican majority. And then now the interesting thing about Texas history and tradition, it's actually a cousin in some ways to common good constitutionalism, which is this really aggressive form of, quote, conservative jurisprudence that's come out as the Supreme Court has been more firmly conservative. So you have both the justices using a doctrine that gives them lots of discretion, which is this text history and tradition, internally gives them lots of discretion. And then you have outside the court, this kind of budding conservative legal movement that's departing from the traditional conservative legal movement that wants to cabin justices into a much more limited role. And now they want to expand what justices can do into this sort of the common good constitutionalism. And it's all the same thing. Whatever branch of government you control suddenly needs to be the branch of government with the most autonomy. And you just see this all the time. I mean, Obama, pen and phone, remember that? You know, Democrats fell in love with executive authority around the time of DACA and, you know, all of that. And so when you control a branch of government, the temptation for a political movement is to try to make it more powerful and to try to make all the others less powerful. And this is, you know, part of that human will to power.
And apropos of that, you know, the fact is that while the Republicans were winning 5 out of 6 presidential elections, they were consistently losing congressional races, right, and the Democrats controlled the Congress. Yeah. And so they wanted to enhance the power of the executive at the expense of the Congress.
Right.
Linda, did you want to comment?
Yeah, you know, I have quipped to you, Mona, that this decision is entirely wrongly named. It should not be called the immunity decision. It should be called the impunity decision, because what is really being conferred here is a kind of impunity. The kind of impunity, by the way, that the United States has always complained about in non-democratic governments, that when a president can exercise power without having to be held account to a constitution, to normal rules, it's very dangerous, and it leads to a kind of authoritarian government. So I think that's what is going on here. And with respect to Bill's comment about this having come about when President Reagan was in power, I think really what this is really all about is power. It's about whatever institution your party controls, you want it to have more power. And I think what we have really seen in recent years is a degradation and Congress really not exercising its own legislative powers and deferring to the executive branch, passing laws and then deferring to executive branch agencies to write regulations that much more thoroughly lay out the terms of what the legislation means. And I think it's very dangerous. And I just don't understand how they could support this and think about what, you know, how they would feel with whether it was a President Obama, a President Biden, or a future President Harris exercising those same powers.
Right. Damon, I'm just going to smuggle in one more complaint about this decision, my question to you, because I forgot to mention it with David. But, you know, they also did this one other thing where they talked about the areas. So there's core presidential authority where he's absolutely immune. And then there's the broader immunity, the presumption of immunity in the outer perimeter of his core powers. And there the prosecution would have to prove that prosecuting the president would impose no, would there be no dangers of intrusion on the executive branch. No dangers, as Sotomayor pointed out in her dissent. Well, that's an awfully hot, steep hill to climb, right? So basically, this decision immunizes a huge swath of presidential action.
It does. And I really liked a lot of things David said in his remarks, and in the interest of trying to keep this not from, you know, we could have done a whole show just on Trump v. U.S. But a few brief notes on that point, Mona. I think that's right. And to link it up with David's point about this being an outgrowth of an attempt to enhance the power of the presidency when the presidency was the branch of government that Republicans were, you know, very attached to and had a lot of stake in. There is also the added complication that this decision greatly enhances the powers of the Supreme Court as well, because they're the ones who have to make all these judgment calls. Wait, is this immune? Is it an unofficial act? Official act? Is it an intrusion or not? And so you have this kind of then potential future collusion where you have a president who becomes ever more wayward and exercising what we thought might be illegal powers. And then the decision about whether, in fact, it is a prosecutable offense goes to the Supreme Court, where they get to make the call. And we're sort of living through a version of that now as the lower court tries to figure out, Jack Smith is trying to read this and figure out, wait, which of these charges could possibly make it past this gauntlet that's been established by the Supreme Court? And in the end, it's probably going to have to go back to the Supreme Court for them to make that call. So that's an interesting point. My final point is that I would say I'm perhaps a little more ambivalent about this ruling, that certainly than you are, Mona. I think I sensed a little bit of hesitation in some of what David was saying, so maybe he and I aren't that far apart. I sort of follow Jack Goldsmith and all things related to these questions. And he also, I think his response was also sort of ambiguous about the awfulness of it. I agree it could be potentially very dangerous. But that second slippery slope that David mentioned, the slippery slope of now that we've had an executive who has been prosecuted for crimes, we are now on the far side of a threshold we have never been before. And, you know, is it conceivable to imagine in the last generation, we had a lot of people on the left who would have loved to bring George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and others in the Bush administration up on charges of crimes for the Iraq War, for torture, things like this. Is it conceivable that there could be a kind of left-wing Democratic president who would try to do that after a controversial war, saying, well, we did it with Trump, now we can do it with this person, and then let alone the completely potentially frivolous things that a Trumpian Justice Department might try to do in prosecuting a Joe Biden or some other Democrat down the road. And given that we're past that threshold, I have some real empathy for the justices in thinking we have to somehow set up some guidelines for what's in play, what's ruled out of play, and then this ambiguous area in the middle where we have to just make the call on the basis of the facts in that particular case as it comes up. Like, I feel for them and having to do that, and it's not something I would have anticipated 6 months ago, where I thought, of course, Trump can't be immune for what he did on January 6th. You've got to be kidding. If anything should be illegal, it's a self-coup. And yet, reading the decision, I sort of was like, yeah, you know, these are real problems that we now face because you're not supposed to have a president like that. Well, leave it at that.
One thing to amplify on your point, Damon, is also remember when this decision was decided, Trump was the prohibitive favorite to win re-election, and he's promised to prosecute his opponents. So it's not like they're looking at something that's a pie in the sky, possible hypothetical. That's why I went out of my way to say, look, it's a legit policy question how much you want to protect a prior president from prosecution by a future president. That's a legitimate question to raise. It's just decided by the founders already, not by the court. That's my main point. If we want to reopen it and have a conversation about a constitutional amendment, let's have that conversation. But I will also note that I do think that the concerns about prosecuting people, like, say, George W. Bush for war crimes or whatever, it's just really overblown. It's just really overblown. Look, I read all the articles back in the day about Bush and his alleged war criminal status. They were laughable. They were laughable.
I agree with you.
And so a lot of this stuff is just like, okay, we went 200 plus years without this conception of immunity. And guess what? We've also had 200 plus years of experience with governors not having this immunity and being able to be prosecuted and actually being prosecuted.
And gone to jail.
And gone to jail without American democracy collapsing in on itself. In fact, it's enhanced American democracy. And also we have examples of from foreign countries that are democratic advanced countries that do actually prosecute former presidents. And they have not collapsed into banana republics. I do know that banana republics exist and they prosecute leaders, but we're not that. And our peer countries are not that. And so we actually have a lot of like real life living examples of how to hold chief executives accountable without collapsing democracy.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much, David. With that, we will turn to our highlight or lowlight of the week, and I'll start with Bill Galston.
Well, my highlight is that I'm still on Cape Cod. my lowlight is the replacement of the assassinated leader of Hamas with Mr. Sinwar, who, if anything, is worse. And there was actually a contest to replace, you know, Mr. Hania. And the guy who lost was the favorite of Turkey and Qatar. The guy who won, Mr. Sinwar, is the favorite of Iran. So I really do not know what Mr. Netanyahu was thinking. But whatever he was wrong.
Okay. Linda Chavez.
Well, I have a somewhat cheerier highlight. There was a good piece in the Matt Iglesias Substack Slow Boring by David Brockman and Josh Kalla called What's Better Than Calling Trump Weird? It's based on their research that shows that telling people what they already know is not very helpful, doesn't move people in the direction you want them to go. And whether or not you think Trump is weird, people have already made up their minds about Trump. So trying to define Trump as anything is probably a fruitless task. And their suggestion is that if you want to people to support Kamala Harris, then you've got to begin to define her. And they've got to be convinced that she is interested in the kind of kitchen table issues that ordinary people are interested in. I thought it was a good piece and worth reading.
Okay. Damon Linker.
Well, 6 months ago or so, my highlight was a novel by the novelist Paul Auster called Baumgartner, which I liked very much. It turned out a couple of months later, Paul Auster died in his 70s of lung cancer, which is very unfortunate. But I haven't read other novels of his, so I asked around to my friends who know a lot about the literary world and said, you know, what's his greatest novel? What should I read? And the consensus seemed to be a book called The Book of Illusions, a novel from 2002. And I've read it and it is really wonderful. So listeners who are interested in a good read over the summer, detaching a little bit from politics, which is especially clamorous this summer, I very much recommend Paul Auster's novel, The Book of Illusions. I won't even get into what it's about, but it's very interesting, a really great literary novel.
Thank you for that. David French.
So I got a very similar highlight and lowlight. Highlight, okay. USA, USA, USA. We're up in the medal count, the overall medal count, defeating the People's Republic of China right now. We have 25 more medals as we're recording this podcast than the Chinese do overall. So that's the clear highlight.
Yes.
There's nothing like the Olympics to put me in the Team America mode of America. Blank, yeah. Like, and then the low light is the Chinese have eked ahead of us in the gold count by one.
Oh, no.
So they have 28 right now. We have 27. Now, we've got big Olympic finals coming up with women's basketball, men's basketball. You can expect some golds. We normally dominate in the relays in track and field. But if the Chinese eke out a win in the gold count, I'm going to be ticked. And that's definitely going to be a low light.
All right. Thank you for that. You know, just in response to that, I have to say that I was away. I went up to Chautauqua last week to give a talk and wound up turning on the Olympics for a brief period. And we were watching tennis and I forgot how great tennis is to watch. I used to watch it a lot when I was younger and I'd sort of gotten out of the habit and I'm going to get back into the habit because it was just terrific. And the men's volleys were extensive. I always remembered the men just doing a lot of aces and it wasn't as much fun to watch as women's tennis because women's tennis has so many more volleys, but these men did have a lot of volleys. It was terrific. Anyway, so amen to what David said about the Olympics. I have a highlight / low light. So it's a personal matter. My mother-in-law passed away this week. She was 96. It is a low light for, of course, her passing, but it's a highlight to appreciate the life she led. And I want to say this about her. She was the strongest person that I have ever known. She endured much more than her share of sorrow in her life. She lost a son, a teenage son, to cancer. She then lost her first grandchild who had a heart defect and died right after birth. She then lost a second child to cancer who was in middle age, late middle age, and she sat by her bedside every single day during about 6 months of illness. And then she lost her husband to early dementia. And yet, she had a full life and she managed to find joy in what she had. She had two surviving children, five grandchildren, many great-grandchildren, and a very rich community and friendships that were lifelong, some of them formed in early childhood, lasting into her 90s. And that was her source of strength and her source of meaning. And she found joy in what she had and focused on what she had and not what she had lost. And she was an inspiration. And I wish that Penny Parker rests in peace. And with that, I want to thank our special guest, David French, and my regular panel, our producer, Jim Swift, and of course, our viewers and listeners. And Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.